Welcome to the Deep End by OnDeck, a podcast where visionary builders, creators, and experts discuss world-changing ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kosloff. Let's dive in. With the Deep End, we're creating a space where we skip the surface level and go in-depth into ideas that matter. I'll be your guide as we explore possible futures of commerce, higher education, art, governance, longevity, and more, with some of the most exciting figures in their respective fields. Joining me today in the Deep End is Eric Torenberg, co-founder and chairman of OnDeck. Many who discuss the future of higher education do it from a purely academic perspective, not Eric. He's on a mission to build OnDeck into a modern educational institution for the future of work. There's a reason why people are always tweeting about how the most talented people they know have joined OnDeck. It's become the place top talent and ambitious builders go to accelerate their ideas and careers, empowered by a world-class community of their peers. OnDeck is guided by Eric's compelling ideas about what's causing incumbent universities to fail and the opportunities that exist for new institutions that choose to chart a different path. We discuss ideas ranging from unbundling and cost disease to talent identification and credentialism. These ideas apply far beyond OnDeck. They're critical to understanding where education is headed around the world. The Deep End is produced by OnDeck, where top talent goes to accelerate their ideas and careers. We hope that those who listen to the ideas on the show are inspired to build. To learn more about OnDeck's programs, visit beyonddeck.com. For show notes and additional resources related to The Deep End, check out ideas.beyonddeck.com. All right, let's dive in. Torenberg, welcome to the Deep End.
It's great to be here.
We are going to discuss a topic that is near and dear to your heart, future of higher education. But the reason why I love this topic so much is you've done a lot of really interesting thinking on a lot of other different topics that we could actually deconstruct through the lens of higher ed. So we're not just talking about colleges and universities, we're also talking about decentralization, centralization, bombers, cost disease, all the really great things. So let's just start here. For as long as basically you and I can remember, we went to college during the late 2000s, the late aughts, there has been talk of higher education being a bubble, of how there are all these problems in the space and how there are these outdated brick and mortar universities. All of it's really being offered is a credential. Yeah, it's the best years of your lives. Was that really worth $50,000? All of those narratives were basically put to the test over the past year, when due to COVID, you had schools transitioning instantaneously to Zoom. So as someone who's been thinking about this space for a long time, it'd just be great for you to reflect on how or how not have the past 14 months or so impacted or demonstrated or really just run experiments with people's narratives in this space.
Well, I think first it's helpful to even just zoom out and say, what were the complaints that people have been saying for the past decade? And they're numerous. One is, you know, the cost has gotten way out of control, risen, way past inflation. Two, there's way too much student debt. Three, there's way too many students dropping out. I think it's almost 40% at this point that aren't completing. Four, there's just too big of a mismatch between what graduates get from going to college and then what employers want. And you're seeing that in the statistics. And then there's no competition. And then also there's a broader question of like, what is the purpose of higher ed, right? Is it to get a job? Is it to become a critical thinker? Is it a four-year party? Whatever the purpose is, they're failing on that purpose, except for the party. On a price per comparative to going to the club every night, it's actually quite a good deal financially. But there was a broader question of, okay, you have all these criticisms, what's the alternative, right? And we had MOOCs, massive online open courses a decade ago, which basically took the same content that you were learning at MIT or Harvard and put it online. And everyone thought, okay, this is going to be the big disruptor. And it turned out it wasn't, not even close, because I think we misunderstood what exactly college is, right? It's not only what you learn. It's this bundle. It's the education. It's the network. It's the credential. And it's this experience that people get. And I think what you realized is that you couldn't just unbundle it. You had to rebundle the exact value prop. And it, of course it's things beyond that, right? It's social, you know, it's friendships, it's dating, it's coming of age, it's getting away from your parents. It's all these things, right? And so I think what the last year in COVID showed is it not only unbundled the education, but it also bundled all that experience, the network, the in-person. And what it really showed is that you're paying all this money, $250,000 and rising for the credential, right? And so what you've seen in the last year, it's coincided with EdTech getting really hot, right? OnDeck raised $20 million. You know, Reforge, another sort of you know, online school, raised $20 million. You know, Maven, the other day, more of a platform for cohort-based courses, similar to what we offer, you raised $20 million. And so I think on the startup side, people are seeing, okay, the emperor has no clothes. It's so expensive for what it's offering. And yet still there aren't alternatives. And I think on the student side, we're starting to see just more and more demand for continuous learning and also college supplements and replacements.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I'm curious on the OnDeck, and OnDeck was in person during the same period. So you also had to go through the experience of transitioning these in-person cohorts online. What were your lessons from that experience? Because this is something which basically everyone, every company, every university, even a small startup had to really navigate through.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I mean, the big change for OnDeck basically is that we went global right away. So we were just in San Francisco, and then we had a chapter in New York. We were limited to people in those cities. And what we didn't realize is the latent demand for our type of experience globally. I mean, now San Francisco and New York are tiny fraction, and we have a whole international team that's focused on doing that. And because, you know, Peter Thiel said that colleges are nightclubs in that they get their status not from who they let in, but from who they exclude, right? You know, Harvard, Stanford, Princeton have only 6,000, you know, people a year that they can accept. Although, of course, there are more than 6,000 people in the world who are qualified to get in, but you know, it's an exclusion-based credential. We're not that. And so we were able to scale from one program to, you know, 17 programs across different verticals and different categories. And it was really because we were able to harness a global, you know, global audience, but also because we're digital first, digital native, we can attract people from all ages. We can attract people at, you know, 1/100th of the price point that colleges offer. And that just expands the market massively. So that's sort of one meta learning. But then the other learning is how to just do remote really well. And what we've seen in the last few years that didn't exist a decade ago is that, and this is why OnDeck couldn't have existed a decade ago, is that the tools are just so much better, right? Not just Zoom and Slack, but all the other no-code stack that we use to run our company, to run our operations, and to facilitate great you know, experiences between the fellows.
You know, and the concept I want to pull out here is what you are basically saying is that online enabled OnDeck to expand the number of seats that had access to. And if you're looking at one of the critiques of the higher education system is that actually for a long time, a lot of the value of holding that credential is that by restricting the seats, by not expanding, there's obviously far more qualified people that could go to Harvard, Stanford, MIT than actually go. So can you just reflect on the idea of expansion and keeping, you know, the pool of people really limited, and how that can maybe provide opportunities for folks to think about this differently?
What I hinted at earlier is that education has become unbundled with MOOCs and just the content, you know, directly out of their classroom into on the internet. That's amazing. Networks are starting to get unbundled. Things like Y Combinator, things like OnDeck, you know, a lot of vertical specific, you know, gap year programs and other types of, you know, digital experiences where people can build really strong networks. The credential is the last thing. And what COVID showed is that people are really, you know, paying $250,000 for the credential. And the sort of credential we have right now is you either got in or you didn't. You went to Harvard or you didn't. And you also, by the way, there's a thing called the sheepskin effect, where basically the data shows that, you know, if you divide college into 8 semesters, the difference between people who finish the 7th semester and 8th semester, i.e. people graduate, people who drop out last minute, is massive. And it would imply that, you know, you're learning so much during this last semester. But of course, that can't be true.
You mean by their employment outcome, right?
Yes. Yeah. And of course, that can't be true. And so really, it's like it's this binary thing. What the internet allows is a much more granular way of looking at credentials from sort of this macro, like, did you get in, did you didn't, versus more of, okay, what are your competencies? What are you actually skilled at? What can you do? And there are areas we call them proof of work areas, like code and design, where you could just show your work, and there are platforms that have emerged, vertical specific, like GitHub for developers and Behance for designers, where just a portfolio of what you've built is way more signal than you majoring in computer science. And in terms of, like, you know, what an employer is actually looking for. So that's sort of, you know, credentials 1.0 in terms of upgrade there. Now, not every field is show your work. And so one thing I've been really excited about, we experimented this with this project called Cosign, which we'll bring back at some point, is sort of peer-to-peer credentials, right? Where it's, if you were to tell me, or, you know, maybe 100 people I trust were to tell me who are the 5 people that they really respect who are under 25, I would probably value those recommendations more than a Harvard degree. And for you, in terms of, like, who I'd rather hire. And for you to tell me that is free for you. Like, that is just information that's in your head. You haven't told it to me. And if we could get that information out there on a platform, I think that would encourage people to build credentials in a different way. Because in a very competitive job market, people are looking for any angle that they can get. And right now, colleges have a monopoly on credentials. And as soon as that's unbundled, I think that's the last leg to fall in terms of everybody going to college.
I'm fascinated by the credential idea, but here's where where there's just, like, a bottleneck potentially, which is basically, I just see a world where you could have all these, like, super, you know, pure credentialed people, and it's all the, you know, Stanford class of 22 crew. Yeah. You know, so how do you basically surmount the fact that the thing that college is still best at, especially at the elite level, is, hey, we're going to take a lot of really smart, really ambitious people, throw them in a room together for 4 years. And it doesn't really matter, like, how much they learn, because, as you're pointing out, no one actually really cares. I mean, you had this tweet, which I failed to properly say was yours last time we talked on a podcast. I always say it properly. You had this tweet where you said the smartest move you could make is get into Stanford and then drop out on day one before they actually have their tuition checks due. So, but given that, how does credentialing not just end in, once again, elite people just recommending other elite people? Because it feels like the advantage of credentialing, especially outside of tech, could be, hey, here's this ambitious person. They might not have the right degree. They might not have gone to the right school. They might not be in the right network, but they've been really recommended by these other people who can elevate them. How would we think about credentialing in that context?
One way to think about colleges is that employers have outsourced 2 sort of tests to colleges. One is IQ tests, and 2 is conscientious tests. And the IQ test is via the SAT, and the conscientiousness is sort of via grades and do you graduate. Other ways to measure just aptitude, because what you don't only want is just IQ. You want actually, like, specific, you know, can this person code? Can this person design? Does this person have the domain expertise and the aptitude to develop it that we're looking for? And then the conscientiousness of, like, you know, is this a person that I want, you know, to work at my company? Are they gonna work well with people? And so right now, if you were to say, you know, that, the amount of elite credentials exist are Ivy League schools, or all the kids that are in Ivy League schools. So that's, like, I don't know, it's like 15 schools times, like, 6,000 or whatever that math is. And you were to say, okay, here's this world of peer-to-peer credentials where, you know, you have your top 5, Mark Andreessen has his top 5, Balaji has his top 5, everybody has their top 5. And I would value that as much as an Ivy League credential. What that would do is raise the amount of elite credentials by, I don't know if it's 10x, I don't know if it's 100x, I don't know if it's maybe 1,000x. So I think it's not a perfect solution. There's still going to be people out there who don't have networks, who are not discovered, but it's a materially better solution. So I think we want some combination of totally open source ways by which anybody, you know, with an internet connection can prove how smart they are, how impressive they are. You know, Pioneer, our friend Daniel Gross's startup, is trying to do that, to create a game where anyone in the world can prove themselves, but also areas in which people who may not have the money or may not have the grades, because they learn in a different kind of way to get into Harvard, but are really impressive, to also just showcase how good they are. But I just say that you're going to need a diversity of solutions in order to capture the diversity of talents that people have.
No, and that builds on a point that you've written about, which is the fact that part of the reason why the system works the way it is that college is a monopoly. And it's a bit misguided of me to say, well, hey, peer-to-peer credentials won't solve everything, because the way you attack a monopoly is it has to come from a bunch of different parts. Because your point is that if college is a bundle, it's the credential, it's the four-year party. That's the part which we're probably going to solve last, to your point earlier, but it's the four-year party, it's the education, it's everything there. So we should be approaching this from a bunch of different processes. So this is where I think a quote I see everyone that I really just love, which is Jim Barksdale from Netscape saying, you know, there are only two ways to make money on the internet. Famous saying, you bundle things and you unbundle things. So let's just play a quick thought experiment. Let's say that your best case scenario of over the next 10 to 15 years, all these different parts of the university system are unbundled. How would they possibly bundle together again? Maybe that's playing too far in the future, but if it's just this cycle that we're seeing in across every industry, it'd be fascinating to see when someone says, hey, you know, we're doing tutoring sessions. I know you're doing some of those. I'd love to talk with about that. We're doing tutoring sessions. Hey, maybe we should have a certificate that says you were received this tutoring thing. And then it just scales back up again. How do you think about this part?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, what we learned is that the first 10, 20 years of ed tech were about taking education and putting it on the web. And so we got, in a very schemophoric sense, so we got, you know, MOOCs, we got Masterclass, we got online tutors. And what we're seeing now and for the next 10 years is that the internet will change what we mean by education. What I think that'll look like is sort of what we talk about, you know, OnDeck, Lambda, Pioneer. The one tangible lesson is that, you know, it's not just the content that is scarce, it's the motivation to learn. And the motivation to learn is increased with other people. And so you've seen the rise of cohort-based courses, which is internet native, but also just takes the best of what we've seen in terms of what inspires people to learn and build relationships. And then if you take that and you have a rigorous admissions process, similar to what we've seen great colleges do, because yeah, for all the critiques I have on great colleges, they know how to run an admissions process and they know how to build a credential that really matters. And then they also know how to create an environment where people build relationships that last for decades, and to create context for people that even if you didn't go to Stanford or whatever school, or at the same time as somebody else, if you went to the same school 30 years from it, you could say, oh wow, you went to a football game or whatever other rituals that they have in common, and build relationships there. So I think what we're seeing is companies right now are taking the best of what colleges do and the best of what the internet does, which is makes things scalable, accessible, fraction of the cost, and rebundle these solutions together. But you probably might start with an unbundle, and then you might add some of the other components on top of it.
Yeah, I want to actually talk about, because you just referenced the learning idea, and something that has really frustrated me ever since I started podcasting, maybe this will resonate with you too, is I wasn't very motivated to just read and study and do all those things. But over the past few years, like ever since I started just lurking, I only lurk on Twitter, but ever since I started lurking on Twitter, since I started listening to more podcasts, doing them, I just got really excited about reading and learning. That wasn't something that I was particularly jazzed about during college as much. I've read more in the past 2 years than I read straight up in the last 10. As someone who's going and looking into these different like tutoring opportunities, how do you think about how people could have learning delivered? Because if we're going to critique a bit of the current system, it's that it doesn't optimize for that process. It didn't matter that I straight up only read 3 or 4 books during college, because I still got the credential anyways, I'm still here. So how do you just think about the learning aspect of this?
Yeah, I think there's a broader question around how does one become the person who wants to read more, into the spirit of like, it's not just the content, it's the desire to learn that is scarce. And I there's this great quote, of course, around like, you're the average of the 5 people you spend your most time with. And what the internet has done is it's made it so that you can just have much more deliberate choice of who are the 5 people you spend your most time with. Like it used to be, the people in your dorm, you could like read Ben Franklin's like biography or whatever and get some of it. And that's amazing. That's great. But you could follow like Balaji all day on Twitter. and like, even if you're in a different place and if you're friends with him, you could be in a group chat with him. So one, there's just way more access to the people that you want to be in terms of their brain on a day-to-day basis. But then also there's just so much more ability. And yeah, not everyone's going to be able to be in a group chat with Balaji, but you will be able to, the internet does enable you to be in a group chat with people who are on the same trajectory of you and want to be in the same. So it's so much it's more easier than it's ever been to have control over the five people that you want to be in terms of where you spend your time with, either in a, you know, peer to peer relationship or even in a, you know, parasocial, you know, one to many relationship. And I think that's fascinating. And then in terms of solutions, one thing I'm really interested in is that there are all these professors who are, you know, world-class in what they do, but don't like working in this these bureaucratic institutions where they don't have, they don't get paid super well necessarily, or they don't have control over their time, or they don't feel they have intellectual freedom. And in the same way that Substack has provided so many new opportunities for journalists, right? Where either like someone like Matt Iglesias or Gretel Greenwald just gets paid what the market actually thinks that they deserve, which is like 3x what they were getting paid otherwise, or it just enables, you know, new people who didn't want to work at a legacy institution to just go totally independent. I think we're going to see the same thing in academia. And we start to see these little pockets. We have Justin Murphy, Michael Millerman, these sort of these professors, these researchers who are doing intellectual work publicly and charging for it. And then also they're teaching publicly and finding an audience on the internet. So I don't know if there's a whole separate platform for that. I don't know if that platform is actually Substack, but I think we're going to see the same, we're going to see phenomena where professors go D2C. And as a result, the best ones make a lot more money. And also there's just a lot more people that become professors and it expands the market.
Yeah, I just want to double click on what you're saying, because the point here, Substack doesn't get rid of journalists. Substack right. doesn't get rid of existing newspapers. What it does is it says, hey, if you're in the top 5%, you are carrying much more weight in terms of audience interest, in terms of subscription generation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you now have this option of exiting that system in order to make much more money. So your point here is that if we're thinking about this vision for this, it wouldn't be that every, you know, there's not going to be a OnlyFans for professors. I guess OnlyFans could technically do that too. It's not technically just for porn. Yeah. But it's not going to say that that is going to replace the university. It's going to say that there are going to be opportunities if you are just that 10x person who can do this. And I know, for example, there's a lot of beef with, you know, Scott Galloway in the tech community. But that being said, at a pure performative, drawing an audience, creating companies around yourself, he's really a good model of how people are going to really develop that in different verticals other than just business and finance. So something that I want to talk about, because you keep on referencing the internet and we're also saying Bology, I suggest anyone who's starting with this episode also go check out our other episode of Bology that's being cross-posted at the same time. He had this great quote where he said essentially that any institution that came about before the internet is going to be fundamentally disrupted or replaced by it. And we hinted at this a bit during the monopoly discussion, but if we're seeing the internet fundamentally break institutions like journalism, it's bringing into mind entire new questions of governance, everything like that. Why at a core level, beyond just the obvious point of like the credential discussion, has the education industry, and this includes K-12 education as well too, so we're not just talking about universities, how has this just been able to survive the longest, when if you're actually looking at the customer satisfaction, quote unquote, it's near the lowest point? You also had this great, you had this really great post about how trust in institutions has just declined since the 1960s, and everything within that theme of the internet challenging legacy institutions, but also of those institutions themselves losing credibility, should apply to K-12 education and higher ed. So what's the broader narrative story that you think is going on here?
Yeah, there's a few things here, and one, just to close the loop on the Substack for professors. One reason why I'm so excited about that is because, you know, to your point, Substack didn't kill legacy institutions, but also, you know, the thing with college that's interesting is that you spend all your time in structured learning environments, many of which don't work for most people. You know, and then after that, you're like basically done for the rest of your life in terms of structured learning. And it's just so ironic that at the point at which you finish college, you know, a few years after that, you finally get the maturity to your point earlier of like, okay, now I'm actually curious to learn so much of this stuff, and yet there's nothing for me. And so that's why, you know, continuous education is such an opportunity. That's what we're doing with OnDeck, is taking that bundle, the college bundle, and applying it to someone's entire career. And so I'm excited for college professors to get access to that, you know, demographic that, you know, most people don't have tutors right now. And that's how we used to learn. But I'm excited for a world where many people do. And that seems like a new market opportunity. And comparison to media, it's because it's not like people stop reading the news, right? People still read the news throughout their lives. But now it's just better content. And now academics are competing with nothing. So it's or with other uses of time. So it's a big opportunity. In terms of why education has lasted for higher ed has lasted for so long, it's interesting on two fronts. So one is what Silicon Valley doesn't appreciate. I have this post on how to build curation businesses. And curation businesses are universities, accelerators, venture capital firms, sort of talent businesses, is that they're really defensible, right? There's this line where since 1520, only 85 institutions have remained continuously in existence, and about 70 of those 85 are universities, right?
What are the other 15? That's what I'm really wondering.
Good question. The church, religious institutions, and it makes sense to compare them in some ways, right? Like, you know, the church has had its fair share of criticism, to put it mildly, and yet it's still kicking, right? Like, these are, you know, institutions that have very long feedback loops are very hard to disrupt, right? And universities have incredibly long feedback loops, right? Like, someone goes through a university, the university then takes credit for their success for the rest of their life. And the rest of their life is like, you know, 50 to 80 years in the working world. And so in order for a new university to come on the scene and say, hey, we make people successful too, you have to wait like 60 years, right? You have to have them go through the program and then become super successful and then credit their success to your experience. And by the way, there's this double effect where also, like, once you've gone through that university, you are incentivized to make that university seem as good as possible because you've adopted it to your identity. So even if it didn't like help you get that successful, if you're putting it as your in your biography, you're incentivized to say, oh, this is for the top people and it's really successful, so that future people will continue to go through that university and make it that network and that credential even more value for you. It's a sort of this like pyramid scheme in a bunch of different ways. And so Marc Andreessen in a recent Andreessen Horowitz podcast episode, someone asked him, what will last longer, Harvard or the United States? And he picked Harvard. And he said, whatever comes after the United States or the philosophy that undergirds it will likely be sort of created at Harvard. And Harvard has preceded, existed prior to the United States. And a lot of the dominant, ideologies that have come to place have emerged out of Harvard or people who are in that milieu. So I think it's worth giving credit to credit to in terms of the business model of universities and just in terms of, or the, I should say, the product and how durable it is. And people in Silicon Valley don't appreciate it because they like to focus on tech moats and data moats. You know, we talk about Amazon and Facebook and Google. And yeah, these are immensely defensible companies. But, you know, 50 years from now, they'll probably be disrupted in the same way that IBM was disrupted, same way that, you know, Microsoft's still doing great. But and some of these might not exist, whereas Harvard and Stanford will 100% exist. That's the positive. The more negative reason would be because we have created basically an accreditation cartel where universities have special privileges given by the governments. They have sort of special tax write-offs, tax exemptions at the company level, the endowment level, you know, federal subsidies for research, for student loans. And the only way you get those advantages if you're an accredited university. For new universities to become accredited, it's an incredibly painstaking effort. Most of them, you know, don't get approved. And it's so painstaking that most people don't even want to try doing it. And this is why, you know, regulated industries are just so hard to compete in. And people often go to other ones. Those are a couple of reasons why it's just been so hard to compete.
Yeah. And I just want to build on what you're saying here, because it's the, you know, curation business aspect, but I also think something that hasn't quite happened yet with any alternative to the broader higher education system is just think of an intangible thing like a sports team, right? Like, some of my earliest, I'm from Oregon and you went to Michigan. So like, there's obviously like, huge sports programs. I remember when I was four, just seeing Oregon Ducks gear at the store and thinking, hey, like, I want to do that. I wasn't thinking about school. I was basically in kindergarten. So what do you think, whether it's on deck or it's a tutoring type thing or anything, what are the equivalents of just those intangible things of the community part of affiliation, right? Like, that's a huge part of the university thing, because it's not just that. Cause I think your Ponzi scheme point is very funny about, like, oh yeah, like, U of O is awesome, and I need to say U of O is awesome, or else people will think that U of O isn't that useful on my resume. There's the cynical take there, which is also directionally true, but there's also, hey, like, I want to pump U of O up because I want U of O to succeed, because the U of O is a part of my identity. I have a U of O like hat over there in the corner. So how do you think that part can be captured by these alternatives?
Communities that become part of people's identities are immensely valuable for the reasons you mentioned and that we've discussed. And I think in a sort of world in which religion plays less and less a role in people's lives, and people are, you know, way more transient, and there's just a lot more chaos, people are searching for new identities, for things that ground them in certain values and in certain groups of people that they want to be a part of and that they feel represent them. And I think universities for many people have become that. I like to say that great communities are all about value and values. And by value, I mean utility, like what brings them there in the first place? What is the reason by which they gather such that they are better off for it? And values is what are the reasons that they keep gathering? What is the reasons that they want to put this as part of their identity, because it says something about them as a person that they feel really represents them? And communities that are able to do that just become immensely defensible. And so in order, you know, the big mistake that a lot of communities make is that they try to do one without the other. They really focus on the set of values and the set of, you know, rituals and the set of what the identity represents, but they don't think about the tangible utility to get people coming in the door in the first place. And others focus on, you know, make the mistake of focusing on purely utility. But if you don't focus on something bigger than that, something that binds everybody together, something that, you know, they want as part of their identity, you end up with sort of this transactional network that as soon as utility starts to fade even a little bit, people are going to leave and not going to commit to it. And as a result, you know, make the utility stronger. To your point, I think anything that tries to rebundle the educational, you know, experience has to sort of do that as well. And you can think of like football in this context, right? Like, or sports. Some people say, oh, it's frivolous, all this money spent on this. And maybe there's some truth to that. But at the same time, what is football or they're rituals. They're bonding rituals by which the people who do them, you know, create incredible experiences, but also the people who witness them, you know, feel connected to their university and it becomes a part of their identity. And so the question for new competitors is like, what's the digital native version of that? What's the 2021 version of that?
Why did you say digital native? Like, why does that part have to be digital native?
I think digital native solutions often beat out, you know, sort of pre-digital native solutions just because they can compete on areas that the pre-digital natives can't, which are flexibility, sort of access to global talent pool. And if you're, you've seen this with YC, right? YC used to be everybody had to go to Mountain View. We started to see a bunch of people, you know, from all over the world who said, hey, I love the YC network. I love the value prop, but if I leave, you know, Mumbai for my, you know, on-demand startup, you know, that's going to affect my business. So I can't go. And so, and then we, you know, I think YC went remote because of COVID, and I think they're staying remote. But basically there's just like a digital native just better serves a global audience who for whatever reason doesn't want to, you know, spend 4 years in this one specific place, but wants an experience that is better suited to their goals. So digital native is just going to be able to attract better talent pools and serve them. Before YC, before digital native, you didn't really have much of a choice. And so the people that had power were the providers. But now in a world in which there's competition, people are going to compete to serve a global talent network and just cater to their preferences because they bring the value. They're the customer. They're what people want. And so When I say digital native, what I really mean is like customer centric, and what the internet enables is just more customization. It makes proximity not a barrier for people to do so. And that's not to say that, like, I mean, football and sports will still exist and might be a big part of it. But, you know, if you think that opportunity or that talent is evenly distributed, there's going to be a subset of that talent that is not going to want to live for four years in San Francisco or wherever to go to a football game. They're going to want to live where they are, but also be able to have those bonding experiences.
Yeah, we're nearing the end here. And you just said 15 really interesting things. So I want to put all of my podcaster skills to the test and see if we can capture them. Sure. So one, you just said customer, but the key thing here, and this is part of the critique, you aren't really a customer in the higher education system, in the sense that, sure, you're paying tuition, but oftentimes you are getting a federally subsidized student loan, which in various ways isn't directly quite tied to the way you're engaging in the market. So what is a like quick way that you're thinking about good market forces? So I'm not trying to think of like rapacious capitalism and, you know, you sell your, you know, right foot to like make it into your, you know, intro to writing 101 class. But what is a way that maybe you could become more of a customer with the system in a way that doesn't really degrade the experience?
You've nailed it. Basically, the student isn't the customer, which is why the prices have skyrocketed. And they've skyrocketed in conjunction with government subsidies. So the government is basically subsidizing colleges to just keep raising their prices. I think colleges capture 65 cents of every dollar that governments subsidize the loans for, and only 25 cents of that dollar goes to the actual teaching. And basically what we've done is we've created the healthcare system by basically moving to a system of third-party payer where people don't pay for themselves, because there's so many subsidies directly and indirectly built into the system that just breaks down all accountability from customers. And what we've also, you know, this is what happens when the government restricts supply, right? They make it very difficult for other new entrants to emerge. What happens is the price escalates and quality remains stagnant, right? Like, why care if you don't have to? And you can still be a really big business. And then on the other side, government also subsidizes demand with taxpayer funding, causes pricing to rise even higher. And we see similar things happen in housing and healthcare. And if you're asking, you know, what can we do to change that? I think there is there's a few things. One is income share agreements are a really powerful way to make the student the customer again, where colleges are not just dependent on what the government thinks, but dependent on how well their customers do. And it's for career-centric categories that's really amazing. And that's why we've seen, you know, companies like Lambda and others innovate and take business away from universities. I expect that to continue. I think one sample solution in a dream world is that the subsidies are given straight to the students rather than indirectly via the universities. Because, you know, we just mentioned, you know, only 25% of it goes to the teaching. And we have, you know, 40% of, you know, students dropping out and $1.7 trillion in student debt. And if you could give it directly to them and they could figure out almost like a voucher system, what Milton Friedman idealized for K-12, then you'd start to make universities compete on price among other incentives.
Wait, but quick thing, but we kind of do that with Pell Grants, right? So like, is that just not big enough in terms of actually directing? Because there's just been lots of interesting studies that like whenever, yeah. So for example, for international listeners, especially, Pell Grants are things given by the US federal government for underserved and under-income people, from families who can't afford to pay. And whenever you've seen increases in the amount given, that's actually coincided with increases in the cost of university, because if you're an administrator, you're like, okay, cool, students now have an extra $5,000 that they can get paid. So how do you subsidize students without just replicating the dynamics that you're worried about already?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm not familiar enough with the Pell Grants. I wouldn't be surprised if some elements of it are working. And I think the challenge is, yeah, you don't want to put price controls either. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to just look at the data and see that, like, as subsidies have gone up, prices have gone up as well, and that hasn't correlated with an increase in quality. You know, only 25% of it is spent on teachers. A lot of it is spent on administrators or real estate or stuff that just doesn't serve the customer in a super direct way. And then also there's very little competition. I think if you enabled that access, basically you made a level playing field I think you would see, you know, this sort of thousand flowers bloom, and the customers would choose, and the government could be reactive to what the customers are demanding. And some colleges would take that money and do different things with it. So it's less specifically about the money and more about if you just create competition, then universities can use it in different ways and let the customer decide.
Yeah. And last question, you said something that is actually really interesting if you think about it through the right framework, which is Y Combinator, a startup accelerator, went remote during COVID along with everyone else. On Deck also went remote, well, fully remote during COVID. YC and On Deck are both continuing to be remote first because, frankly, in both cases, our own personal biases aside, these are actually better programs when they're done remote because you could have an expanded pool. You could have both organizations can have that founder in Mumbai who couldn't make it to New York or SF in both cases. But universities rushed back to in-person because within the current system at the current prices, in-person is just so much better. So this is our basically like, not request for startups period of the show, but really, if you're thinking about things that could make the university system better in a Zoom distance way, like what would those, in those last 5 minutes, what would those be in a way that would make that experience? Because I guess there's a chicken or the egg problem, because the obvious point is, look, if you dramatically reduce the price of going to Harvard or even going to a good state school, people would be pretty satisfied with the last year. The issue was that they kept the same price and the experience was degraded. But how do you just think about this?
When I think about requests for startups in higher ed, or when I think about what's really broken, it's not as much the experience. You know, students could learn a lot more. They could be better prepped for the job market for sure. But overall, like, there are a lot of people who have a great experience in college. What's the problem is that it's way too expensive. people are going into way too much debt, and they're often like unprepared for the job market. So you might have had a great experience studying political science or art history or whatever it was, but it's just, you didn't really learn that much that's that useful. And so when we say improve the experience, I think it's less like, yeah, you know, Zoom, Slack, et cetera, more like, how do we change the incentives such that one, the price, you know, could be a fraction of what it is. And what universities probably learned when they were remote is that their costs probably decreased significantly. Yeah, they're on all these leases and stuff, and maybe they should get out of these leases. But you know, it's just way cheaper to do it online. So the more they move online, the cheaper it will become, which means they can provide a better experience. And then two is, how do they get closer to what the school, what employers want? And what you saw recently is Lambda launch a program with Amazon that basically trains people to be, you know, to work specific jobs at Amazon. And that should exist with like hundreds of companies where they partner with education institutions, whether it's current universities or new boot camps, and create direct education to employment pipelines. Scott Belsey calls it edu-ployment. So you want to see that pipeline get a lot closer. And then also, I mean, I think this is a way for colleges to serve better, but also as a way to disrupt the monopoly they have is really just credentialing. Really just, how do we get away from sort of this like binary, you were invited to the club or you weren't invited to the club, and more like competency-based, what does this person actually know? And who, you know, that you think is impressive also thinks that they're impressive after spending just a little bit of time. That information is in, you know, millions of people's heads all over the world, and is not legible to the internet. But I think that would, the collection of those things would make the university experience better, cheaper, and it would force it to, you know, actually compete for and treat students like customers. And I'm excited for that future, excited to help build it.
Yeah. And just to build on that real quick, because what you just said helped me realize an important gap that I haven't covered in this conversation, which is, if you're looking, especially at the top tiers of colleges, they are grading people on how they're performing basically from sixth grade up until 12th grade. So it's this very specific period of your time where there's different levels of maturity, different levels of knowledge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what could be promising about this new vision, whether it's the peer-to-peer credentials, whether it's the digital first thing, whether it's the focus on, did you actually learn something, is this could really provide an avenue for people who weren't crushing it at 18 or 14, but are in their 30s and actually want to learn a new skill or actually want to actually have peers back them out that could actually help them re-perform well. So that's, I think that's how anyone who's listening to this should really think about, which is that the way probably to disrupt the higher education system isn't to just say, hey, we're going to found digital first Harvard and do everything that it's trying to do, because that's, to your point, what the MOOCs tried to do in certain respects, is to say, how is this function, this quote unquote job to be done the university has, how can it be filled in a different way? And looking at that credentialing part, looking at those structural things are huge. So huge encouragement to anyone in the audience who has thoughts on that or is focusing on that to really dial in on that. Cause I think that's what's really exciting about all of this.
Yeah, no, I love that point, Marshall. It's not just continuous education, but also continuous credentialing, right? Like if you know, many people in their lives don't mature until their mid-20s, later 20s. And at the time when they're 18, you know, and leading up to it, they didn't have the maturity or the focus or whatever to really get great grades and they wouldn't have got to a good school, or they didn't go to a good school. But then, you know, if you measured them at age 26 or something, or they could restart, you know, 5 years later, they could get into Harvard or whatever it is. And so what are the equivalent credentialing sort of modules that showcase, hey, okay, this person didn't have it all together when they were, you know, 18 or 20, but at 28, they really do. They're really top of the class. And so, that's a really exciting opportunity I hadn't even thought of as well. So.
Great. Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us for these first episodes of The Deep End. I'm sure we will revisit this topic at some point, because I suspect this will not be solved in the next 2 to 3, 4, 5 months, or even years.
Thanks, Marshall, for leading this, and to be continued.
Thanks for joining us in The Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.